Hello, I'm Julian Compton. This is number 0565, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0565. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Washington Post foreign policy columnist David Ignatius, who is the author of his 10th CIA thriller novel. This one is called The Paladin.
The story of this novel is centered around my hero, Michael Dunn, who's a CIA officer who's assigned by his boss to penetrate a kind of quasi-journalistic, quasi-hacking group in Europe run by an American that's doing extraordinary things with technology to create not just fake news, but fake events that are concocted in the computer.
Neil Gibson, founder and editor-in-chief of T-Pub Comics, talks about their new animated series, Battle Suit.
The storyline is about these, in the future, mankind has faster than light travel. They can travel, you know, almost across the galaxy. But they discovered hundreds and hundreds of dead alien civilizations, but not a single living one. And so they sent out these astro-archaeologists to find out, to look at these dead civilizations and try and find out why they collapsed, so humans can try and avoid the same fate. That's the premise for the story, and this particular story has got robots and NECA and AI.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter reviews a new book about the Kennedys by, of all people, mystery novelist James Patterson. The torch will be passed to a new generation of Kennedy biographers later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0565 is Julian Compton, a commercial pilot who has flown both passenger and cargo flights, and currently he's flying for FedEx. Thank you very much, Julian, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An Indian man required surgery after inserting a 2-foot-long phone charger into his penis for sexual gratification.
Can you hear me now?
The unidentified man tried to hide the true cause of his ailment when he sought medical help last month at a hospital in northeastern India, claiming he consumed earphones. The doctors prescribed the man laxatives, but he returned to the hospital 5 days later when he was still complaining of pain.
Can you hear me now?
Dr. Waliul Islam, a surgeon at the hospital, said that despite passing stool several times, the cable did not come out. As the patient complained of severe pain, we decided to perform surgery and found that there was nothing in his intestine. Later, through an x-ray, doctors discovered the phone charger inside his bladder, which is connected to the penis via the urethra.
Can you hear me now?
Said Dr. Islam, I have read that people used to get sexual gratification by inserting instruments through the penis. This is one such case, and the psychiatrist can help him beyond this point. The surgeon said the man recovered, but noted that if he had, quote, been honest, then it would have saved us the trouble and we could have treated him sooner, unquote.
Can you hear me now? Good.
You know what I want to know? During this whole ordeal that lasted over a week, how did he charge his phone? Yeah. Still with items in the body, we go from India to China. A 30-year-old man turned up at Jiangqing First People's Hospital in Guangdong, China, on June the 3rd, suffering from abdominal pain. Doctors performed a series of scans before discovering a freshwater fish in the man's large intestine and the presence of which he had explained by saying he had accidentally sat on it. Do you think I'm an idiot? One of the doctors replied. The spiny fins of the Mozambique tilapia had caused ruptures in the man's intestine and had to be removed through his abdomen by surgery. But the man survived the ordeal and recovered. Okay, I don't know if this item was also caused by sexual exploits, but whatever the cause is, there are some people with way too much time on their hands. An unnamed 29-year-old man in Berlin, Germany, triggered alarms at a supermarket on June the 5th when he tried to leave without paying for $5.65 in merchandise. Police had little trouble apprehending him because, in his hurry to escape, he left his 8-year-old son behind. Not only did the burglar's accessory help police identify him, but the thief fell down as he was escaping and he ended up in the hospital. Yeah, his son will be so proud. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Canadian Glenn Richard Mousseau's adventure with Michigan law enforcement began on May the 10th when he was arrested in St. Clair County driving a U-Haul truck and in possession of $97,000 in cash. He cooperated with authorities, admitting he was the owner of a submarine seized by the Border Patrol April 23rd, and he had been using it to ferry drugs between Michigan and Ontario. Mousseau agreed to await the investigation's outcome in a local hotel, but on May 23rd, federal agents said he had absconded, leaving behind 5 phones, a laptop, and a diving suit. On June the 5th, Border Patrol officers observed packages thrown into the Detroit River from a vessel entering U.S. waters and found Mousseau unconscious in the water with 265 pounds of marijuana tethered to him with a tow strap. He's being held on charges of smuggling and possession of a controlled substance. Dear Lord, this is a guy who is equal parts stupid and determined. It's like a dumb dog with a bone. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Washington Post foreign policy columnist David Ignatius has released his 10th CIA thriller. It's called The Paladin. In his day job at the Washington Post, Ignatius writes about global affairs and the CIA. His new novel walks the line between truth and fiction and grew directly out of the reporting he has done on intelligence operatives and U.S. foreign relations. David joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, David.
Hi, great to be with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You've written 10 novels, but has there ever been a time when truth was stranger than fiction like there is now?
Well, if you wrote the daily news in a novel, people would say it was far-fetched. It's a crazy time, one thing after another. What I've tried to do in my new novel, The Paladin, is to think about one of the questions that faces us almost every day, which is, what is true? Well, the information coming at us, what is designed to mislead or manipulate us? Does it come from abroad? Is it possible it's been created in a deliberate attempt to manipulate? This is an issue that, unfortunately, technology is making much more powerful and dangerous. It's possible now, as my novel explains, to create not just fake news, as President Trump sometimes calls it, but fake events, images and sounds that are created in a computer but appear to be real. And that problem, that nightmare, really, is what hits my hero in the novel, but really, it's something that's hitting all of us in ways we don't even realize.
Well, tell us about the novel itself, what the story is about, and also the idea of the very title, The Paladin.
Well, so the story of this novel is centered around my hero, Michael Dunn, who's a CIA officer who's assigned by his boss to penetrate a kind of quasi-journalistic, quasi-hacking group in Europe run by an American that's doing extraordinary things with technology, as I said earlier, to create not just fake news, but fake events that are concocted in the computer. He does this even though he thinks it may be illegal to go after an American journalist, and I have quotation marks around the word journalist, overseas. He ends up getting indicted and convicted. The novel opens with him being sentenced to a year in prison. And the story really is his attempt to understand why the agency was going after these people, who set him up and left him hanging to dry, and then, in the last half of the book, to take revenge against the people who put him in this terrible position. You ask about the Paladin. The Paladin is a reference to a group of knights in the France of Charlemagne in the 9th century who sought to right wrongs against ordinary people. They were the Avengers. My hero, Michael Dunn, early in this novel, when he's released from prison, gets a letter guiding him toward the people who did this harm to him, and it's signed anonymously, the Paladin. And then we begin to understand who the Paladin, in this case, really are.
Well, between your work as a thriller writer and your work, your day job at the Washington Post, writing about global affairs and the CIA, and as you've already alluded to, the idea of, you know, the term fake news being thrown around, generally speaking, as far as the population is concerned, people seem to run the gamut between believing what they read and hear or delving into conspiracy theories. With someone like yourself who does a lot of research and writes a lot of stories about these kind of things, where on that scale should the general population, in your estimation, be?
So I think as consumers of information, we should be like consumers of any other resource. If a stream is coming at us, we want to know whether if we drink from that stream, we'll get sick, whether we'll be harmed by it. And the stream of information that comes at us can make us sick in different ways. It can harm our decisions about politics if it skews us or divides us. It can lead us to make catastrophic financial decisions if it's manipulated or false information about companies or the economy. So I think consumers of information have to be the guardians of the safety and security of what they take into their information bubble. People are too susceptible, I think, to information that makes them feel good. Oh, that's great. You know, that confirms the things I feel about the world. Let me grab some of that without stopping to ask, how do I know this is true? How do I know that if I act on this information, the outcome will be good for my country or for my investments? Or take your pick. But I think people just need to be smarter as information consumers.
When did you start writing this book? And I ask that question is because was this story born out of the times we literally live in, or was this an idea that came to you and it just seemed to come out at a time when history is paralleling it?
I got an idea back in 2015 or so about the people in this information space who were becoming the manipulators, all the things that it seemed they were able to do with computers. I go to hackers conventions and things like that out of curiosity and to do reporting. And then in 2016, we experienced as a country the assault on our elections by Russia, a very deliberate effort by their intelligence service and people working directly for the Kremlin to interfere in our elections, our democracy. So it was obvious to me that this was a more serious problem than I realized. My challenge was to try to write a novel that was a story that didn't feel like, you know, what you just read in yesterday's paper about Russia or this one or that one, that was a story all its own that had its own characters and intensity, but drew off of what we were learning. The more I got into it, talking to people in the FBI, in the CIA, I realized that the power of computers to create false imagery was way beyond what I'd realized. And I honestly think in another year or two, that's just going to hit us hard. I mean, imagine if in October before the election, a piece of video comes out and we just don't know whether it's true or false because it could have been made in a computer. Think of how disruptive that could be, and that may not be a far-fetched scenario, I'm afraid.
They always say about writers or about authors, write what you know. I mean, you are a person who covers this as a reporter, as a columnist for the Washington Post. You cover global affairs and the CIA, and you write best-selling fiction. Has it ever been a problem when in your day job you come across people, potential sources who might not want to talk to you because they're afraid you might fictionalize them in a book?
You know, it hasn't happened that I know of. You never know why people don't talk to you. So I try to make clear in conversations with sources, with people I encounter. If I'm researching something for a novel, I'll say this is not for my journalism. This will only appear in a fictional version. It will be changed, transformed. But I do try to make that distinction, and I try to be open when I have permission to do so about the people who were kind enough to talk to me in the acknowledgments at the end of this book. I note that the senior official, one of the most knowledgeable officials at the CIA about technology, spoke with me with the agency's permission. I note that the FBI took me to its Center for Digital Forensics in Pittsburgh, shared with me some of the things that they know. I think these agencies are working hard to serve the public, and they actually want somebody who's going to write a novel that's realistic to have good information because they'd like the public to be better informed about these problems, you know, through a novel, if that's the way to do it.
You mentioned in your book that there is a feeling of journalism within some of the characters in the book. You are a journalist that deals with politics. Do you find that in this day and age that we live in, it is easier or more difficult to be a journalist, particularly when you're covering politics?
Well, I think we're obviously under more stress when you have a president who calls us out loud the enemies of the people, and you have a lot of Americans who really don't like journalists, don't believe us. That makes the job difficult. It's never been a popularity contest. I've been doing this for 45 years, and you know, journalists are often roundly disliked, and that's okay. I mean, it's not our job for people to like us. It's our job to tell the truth. I think the difficulty isn't so much the criticism we get as it's getting harder and harder to know what's true. It's so easy to seem to be on one side or another in these debates, to take everything as further evidence that the president is a good guy or a bad guy. That it's as if they're two separate teams in American life. And as a journalist, I was trained to resist that in every way I could and to approach each story and try to interrogate the facts, make sure I knew what was true. And I think that's really the challenge, is avoiding this world of confirmation bias, reinforcing what people already believe, and sticking to the job of challenging people.
Well, congratulations on not one, but two very successful careers. And congratulations on the release of your 10th CIA thriller. This one is called The Paladin. David, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate the conversation, and I hope people enjoy the book.
David Ignatius, author of The Paladin. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0565, and you'll find links to David's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Here's a penny for your thoughts from the Stuff File program coming to you from Montreal, Canada, a country that doesn't have pennies.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the founder and editor-in-chief of T-Pub Comics about a new animated series that he has. Plus, Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, there is an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. The coronavirus pandemic might have spawned what one pest control expert is calling a new rat plague. With many buildings dormant in Sydney, Australia, because of lockdown procedures, hungry rats have been turning to residential homes in the suburbs for a source of food. Jeff Milton, a Sydney-based rat catcher, says that suburban rat infestations have spiked 30% compared to last year. However, with a drop-off in food and garbage in cities due to the pandemic, rats may become more aggressive and quote-unquote hangry, leading to the rodents possibly eating each other if they run out of food options. Oh, this could be interesting in a world that is starved for live sports coverage. I can just see it now. Rats locked in Mortal Kombat while the battle music from Star Trek plays in the background. Yeah, this works for me. Anyway, Peter Banks, a rodent expert from the University of Sydney, said the cannibalism would have happened within days of lockdown procedures being enforced by Australian authorities. The rats have to eat immediately, so this would have happened days after because the rats are so food stressed, said Banks, who noted the rodents depend on humans for food. They will eat other rats that die for sure. It's hard to say whether they'll go and kill another rat. They will not let a meal of another rat go by. Banks did note that people shouldn't worry about rat hordes because the population would have dropped because of the lockdown. Oh, let the fighting begin! A battle to the death, I say! May the best rat win! Vegas needs something to bet on. And while we're on the topic of cannibalism, a California man is accused of being a killer cannibal. Police in Richmond were called to a home following a report of a woman bleeding and a man standing near her. When officers arrived, they were instead shocked and stunned to see a man digging into the remains of a 90-year-old woman. The officers ordered the man, 37-year-old Dwayne Wallach, to halt the gruesome act, but he ignored them and continued what he was doing. Officers used a stun gun on Wallach and also had to physically restrain him before they were able to handcuff him. The woman, identified as his grandmother, Ruby Wallach, was declared dead at the scene. Boy, that's a stretch. Wallach was taken to a hospital for a physical health observation, in other words, a checkup from the neck up. After that, it's off to a detention facility. Wow. And you thought Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer was a heartless, callous song. I mean, this guy went all Jeffrey Dahmer on his meemaw. And speaking of Jeffrey Dahmer, now there was a guy who, during his spree, killed, filleted, and ate his way through 17 young boys and men, and for most of that time, he lived in an apartment building. Didn't any of his neighbors notice anything suspicious? Or, after all was said and done, did reporters have those typical eyewitness news, man-on-the-street conversations with his neighbors? You know, the ones where someone says, "Oh, he was a lovely young man who kept to himself. He often had handsome young fellers always dropping by for dinner. Come to think of it, never saw any of them leave, though." Yeah. I also noticed that before he was murdered in prison, They never let Dahmer have kitchen duties. Just saying. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Neil Gibson, the founder and editor-in-chief of TeePub, is back. TeePub is a British comic book publisher, and they are now branching out into the world of animation. The project is called Battlesuit, and you can catch the premiere episode on YouTube. Neil joins us via Skype from the UK. Hi, Neil.
Hi there. How are you?
Hanging in there. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. Was this always your intention from the beginning to branch out into animation, or was this something that just came about with the growing success of TeePub?
I think it's both, actually. So I've always had an ambition for our comics to be translated into TV and film. What interests me is the Japanese model, because in Japan, it's the most competitive comic book market there is. And what happens is they have weekly comics that come out, and it's compilation of comics. And they get people to vote in from the public, and the bottom two titles in this compilation get cut every week. It's brutal. They just get cut. And then the longer-running series, get the best performing in these compilations get their own series, but then in the company, the worst two performing series each week or each month get cut. And then the best ones get an animated series, and the best ones of those get live action. So they see it as a complete route all the way through. So I thought that as a stepping stone for live action would be animation. But this title in particular, I think, can only be done with animation because it'd be so expensive to do the science fiction thing with live action.
So wait a minute. So is it your idea that one day you will do actually a live action as opposed to animation?
Oh, for our titles, absolutely, yes.
So what is... you would think that from comic to animation is a natural progression, but... Is it a much bigger leap than one would anticipate if one weren't in the business?
I have to caveat this with me saying I don't really know, because I mean, we're talking to producers right now and the ball is rolling. But it is a different medium, and you get people who are screenwriters or book writers and they think they can write for comics, and they don't understand that you need to learn a different skill set for it. So I don't yet know how to make animation or necessarily write for animation, because it's different. But what amazed me was when I was speaking to producers who know what they're talking about and doing, their vocabulary and their knowledge of how certain things just have to work, and things you don't even consider. So is it a natural leap forward? I think it is quite close to comics, more so than the books, but there's still a lot that I don't know. And I don't think you can jump into it expecting to do a good job unless you've been working in the industry a while.
Tell us about Battlesuit.
Sure. So Battlesuit is from The Theory, one of my comics, and it's a story written by David Court. It's funny, because all my stories have twist endings, so I don't want to give it away. But what happened was, the storyline is about these, in the future, there are, mankind has fast and light travel. They can travel almost across the galaxy. But they discovered hundreds and hundreds of dead alien civilizations, but not a single living one. And so they sent out these astro-archaeologists to look at these dead civilizations and try and find out why they collapsed so humans can try and avoid the same fate. That's the premise for the story. And this particular story has got robots and NECA and AI. And the animation came about because I met this director called Haz, because he's going to give me some advice on some U.S. agents. And we just met in a cafe, and we started talking. We got on so well. And he's a massive comic book fan, so I gave him a copy of The Theory. And I left it at that. But he loved that story, because he loves science fiction and robots and female lead characters. And he then just called me up with it in less than a week and said, look, can I make an animation out of this? And that's how it all started.
I've actually seen the work that is done that is on the YouTube page. It's great stuff. Which I think you just kind of answered what I wanted to ask next, and that is, with so many titles you have available since you started TeePub, why was this one picked for the first animation? But I think you just answered that question.
Yeah, it's just Haz was just a big fan of the storyline. What's impressive about it, though, is because if you look at it, it's not quality, it's not Pixar quality, it's not even professional video game quality. But the action scenes in it are phenomenal. That's all down to Haz. But he did this during the lockdown using just a laptop and using Remote Teams. I think that's incredible, because if you said this 5 years ago, you could do this on one computer, the rendering processing power needed, you just wouldn't have believed it. It's incredible how technology advances and allows you to do, you know, near cinematic quality in just on your laptop at home.
It sounds like you're impressed with the process and how it came out, but going in, and you know, this is nothing to do with the times we live in and the lockdown, going into the process, in your mind's eye, when you handed him this, what was your expectations coming out of it, and were you overly impressed by the end result?
Well, going into it, we thought it would be live action, because that's what Haz has done to date. And he's got some films on Netflix. He did the visual effects for The Dark Knight, for example. And he said he knew how he could do it on a really cheap budget, live action, which I thought was fantastic. That's what we were expecting. But after the lockdown, he realized it's not going to be possible. So we pivoted and switched to making an animation. And it gave him more flexibility to tinker it and make changes in real time. So as things were coming, he'd send the daily, as it were, and I'd give him feedback on the storytelling. And sometimes we'd have to get the actors to redo the voices. But the expectation was completely live action. So when we had the switch, that was it. I didn't expect it to be as good as it was.
One of the questions I'm asking a lot of creative types is, in this time that we're living in this world of a lockdown, you know, creativity for a lot of people is an individual situation. So has the lockdown for you, well, let me rephrase that. What are the plus and minuses of the lockdown for someone as creative as yourself?
Well, it's funny, my life actually hasn't changed that much due to the lockdown. The negatives are homeschooling, because when the school's shut, having to, you know, educate my daughter at home. That is a painful experience, as I'm sure any parents out there will tell you. It's a constant question. When is schooling going to start again? That was the negatives for me. But the positives for me, I think it's the more free time that other creatives have had. For me, it hasn't made much difference. But the other people I can work with, because they're stuck at home, they have more time to get involved in creative stuff. So they have more volunteers as well who want to read early scripts or look at the artwork or want to just pitch things. So there's been more of more resources during the lockdown.
Because you're also a writer, and one of the things I've found from talking to other writers or musicians is, because of the lockdown, they're getting more work done because they're just home all the time and they can't go out anywhere.
I wish I could say the same for me. It's not been the case. Of the time I spent writing, less than 5% has been writing. So of time I spent working, less than 5% has been writing, typically. Because I write very fast, but I'm doing much more of the company admin, and I'm editing other people's work. So, for example, I have a call later on today with a guy called Raymond Tyler, who's making a comic book, and we've just getting we've got the first inks for the first issue, and I have to teach him how I edit inks. And that's not writing and me being creative, but it is me working on the product, if that makes sense.
With some of your titles dealing with science fiction, you know the science fiction world pretty well. Another question dealing with this current pandemic and lockdown, how do you think this current situation will infuse some of your writing and stories going forward?
So I don't tend to be influenced by real events, I don't think. Okay, I think as a result of this virus, there's going to be so many people coming up with stories about a virus or a lockdown and things that happen within that, and that will inspire a lot of people. So I'm consciously choosing not to go down that route, to go down other things that other people haven't thought of, if that makes sense.
Makes absolute sense. So in addition to Battlesuit, you have other titles that you're proud of that are coming out or expanding. What are some of the things you're most excited about besides Battlesuit?
So Battlesuit is part of The Theory, and that's out later this year. That's my science fiction one. We're working on The Theory Volume 2. I also, later out this year, is Season 2 of Twisted Dark. That's all finished. I'm excited. Well, the first volume is finished. I'm excited about that. Amputation Capital with Raymond Tyler. That's set in a world where LA is the film capital of the world, it's the plastic surgery capital of the world, it's the porn capital of the world, and it's also the amputation capital of the world. In this story, celebrities, especially celebrities who become B-list or C-list, can sell parts of their body for cash that they need, and collectors buy it. And that's it's a legal business. And it's where that world goes from that. That's the premise of that story. I've also got Trickster coming out with Conor McCreary, who wrote Kill Shakespeare. That's about a leprechaun living in Boston. And why he's there is all the mystery is going to be revealed. And he gets really annoyed that people think he's tiny, because he's 6 foot, and people think he's obsessed with shoes. And his friends point out, yeah, but Rory, you have 300 pairs of sneakers. Shut up!
Wow, we've talked to the we've talked to the writers of Kill Shakespeare over the years, well, from the beginning, so it's interesting to see that you guys are joining forces.
Yeah, well, Connor, he's a great friend of mine, we're a top guy. That reminds me, actually, he sent me a pitch last night. I had to look through, I forgot to do that. He's a really good guy. He stays with me whenever he comes to London. I stay with him whenever I'm in Toronto. And he is a lot funnier than me. So been writing Trickster with him has been a joy.
Excellent. Well, it's great to see that T-Pub is thriving, even in the times we live in, or maybe in spite of the times we live in. People can check out the YouTube version of Battle Suit. It's up there now. It's fun to watch. I thank you very much, Neil, for being on the program with us once again.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to speak to you.
Neil Gibson, founder and editor-in-chief of T-Pub. You can visit my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0565, and you'll find links to T-Pub's site and also to Battlesuit on YouTube. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And fresh from his PT Cruiser, it's Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. That's 109. Don't forget, 109.
109.
And yes. You know, you probably expected me to do my JFK impersonation.
No.
But I won't, because I would end up either sounding like Diamond Joe Quimby or Von Meter.
Oh, man, Von Meter. There's a career that I almost said died, but came to an end rather quickly.
Yeah, there's, put this way, when the day after, Lenny Bruce in his first performance after the JFK assassination, his first words were, "I bet you Von Meter is screwed."
Yes, yes.
That, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, in this edition of Book Banter, yes, we are dealing with the Kennedys, and it's a new book about the Kennedys, but there's a little bit of a interesting twist to it. You see, like I said, written before, and like I said before, when I reviewed any of his previous books, author James Patterson is a human writing machine, whether it be his Alex Cross crime thrillers, mysteries, westerns, police novels, kids' books, YA novels, or true crime accounts. James Patterson manages to churn them out in great quantities every year and have them easily end up on the bestseller list. But what about when Patterson decides to branch out to another literary genre and publishes a political nonfiction book, especially one about America's royal family of politics, the Kennedys? Well, you know, CNN anchor Jake Tapper had something to say about this. When he published his first novel last year called The Hellfire Club, Patterson gently chided Tapper for stepping on his toes as a best-selling thriller writer. But when he read an advanced copy of The House of Kennedy and he liked it, Tapper had this to say, and I quote, "He's too good. It isn't fair," unquote. And so when I finished reading the above-mentioned book, I had to agree with Jake Tapper's reaction. And as well, a certain question popped into my head before I started reading it. The question was, is there anything new James Patterson has to say about the Kennedy dynasty that other authors like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Doris Kearns Goodwin, Theodore Sorensen, and Seymour Hersh have already said in their respective best-selling tomes? And leave it to Patterson to find an angle to make his book a good addition to the Kennedy canon. He focuses on how being a Kennedy has both been a blessing and a burden, and certain members of the family became part of the Kennedy curse, whether it was accidentally or intentionally. Now, Patterson has thoroughly researched his subject to give readers the familiar and not so familiar stories that give you a complete picture of the Kennedy lore, and somehow through his trademark tendency towards writing brief chapters has not lost the necessary depth to tell the triumphant and tragic story of the Kennedy family, whether it be the rise of Joe Kennedy Sr. in the business world, to Joe Jr., to Jack's service in World War II, to the 1960 campaign, to the assassinations of both Jack and Bobby, to Chappaquiddick, and to the tragic and timely death of John Jr. in a private plane crash in 1999. It's all covered in this book. But however, Patterson offers plenty of interesting factual nuggets that keeps this book from being a quickie rehash. And one of my favorites deals with Teddy Kennedy when he first ran for the Senate, U.S. Senate in 1962, to fill a Jack seat that vacated in 1960. So his Republican opponent was Eddie McCormack, who was related to the then Speaker of the House, John McCormack. And he said to Kennedy during a televised debate in August of 1962, said, "If his name was Edward Moore, with his qualifications, with your qualifications, Teddy, your candidacy would be a joke. But nobody's laughing because his name is not Edward Moore. It's Edward Moore Kennedy."
Yes.
Interesting, huh?
And that's what they wanted. They wanted more Kennedy.
Yeah, and they got it. Boy, do they get it. So The House of Kennedy, I found it an enjoyable book. It offers fascinating summing up of the era of tragedy that has plagued the Kennedy family of Massachusetts for nearly a century, and also makes a highly readable introduction to the world of the Kennedys for those who choose this book to read it as an introduction to the vast collection of written works about this American royal family. So the book is called The House of Kennedy by James Patterson and Cynthia Fagan. It's published by Little Brown, and it's $37.
And I would assume that there are several books dealing with the Kennedys that you can just quickly dredge up off the top of your head. So, yeah. Go.
Well, there's, you can read Profiles in Courage by John F. Kennedy, who won a Pulitzer Prize in 1956. There's also two books by Arthur Schlesinger Jr., which are huge tomes. First, there's 1965's 1,000 Days about the Kennedy administration, and one called Robert Kennedy and His Times. It's a huge biography of Bobby Kennedy that was published in 1979. That's just scratching the surface. But also, I wanted to recommend a James Patterson book that's going to be coming out in November, because I think he's caught on to the biographical fever, the non-crime biographical fever, because in November, Patterson has a book coming out called The Last Days of John Lennon. And I'm wondering, Peter, if once this book is released, it kind of makes me wonder if like certain John Lennon or Beatles biographers like Hunter Davies, Ray Coleman, and Philip Norman would think that Patterson will be infringing on their territory as rock music journalists.
Hmm. Doesn't that leave a hole in the genre that Patterson is leaving behind?
Oh, you no, because I'm sure that besides that book, he's probably churning out even more mysteries and thrillers, and because he has like maybe 5-6 series of novels that he churns out. So it's just one fraction of the Patterson output that's coming up this year.
Well, speaking of output, I mean, there are some authors out there that we all know that are extremely prolific. Patterson is one. Stephen King's another. The list goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
As we are currently living in a time where people are quarantining in place, I mean, if these guys were prolific before, my God, what are they churning out now?
Let's see, screenplays, graphic novels, you know, more, I mean, article, newspaper, well, for King, I mean, he does a lot of magazine articles too. It just keeps, and Patterson, besides himself, I mean, he's got a staff of people who helps him write these books too. So it just keeps on going. He's the Energizer Bunny of the literary world.
Okay, and again, this week's book is?
It's called The House of Kennedy by James Patterson with Cynthia Fagan. It's published by Little Brown, and it's $37.
And of course, you know, when you talk about the Kennedys, you can't find a family more littered with tragedy. I'm sure there's a line I'm about to say that I'm sure you recognize because mm-hmm. both you and I were at his live shows many, many years ago before he passed away. And that is, of course, the comedian Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
And Bill Hicks said a line in one of his shows that I swear Coca-Cola came out of my nose. I was laughing so hard. It's a very, very dark line. I'm sure you remember the line. It's very similar to, you know, when somebody says something to drive home a point of the obvious. The line is, does a bear bleep in the woods, right?
Right.
And Bill Hicks's response to that line, or his version of that line, is, does Rose Kennedy have a black dress? And when I heard him say that, I felt so guilty for laughing so hard at that line because that is just brutally honest.
Yeah. I mean, straight to the point. Yeah, you know what? You want dark, edgy humor? Boy, you got in that one sentence.
Oh, yeah. That's, I'm sure many a Catholic who have seen his routines live went straight from the theater to confession.
And if he heard it in Montreal, there's plenty of places to go and confess.
Exactly. Anyway, again, this week's book is
The House of Kennedy by James Patterson and Cynthia Fagan. It's published by Little Brown, and it's $37.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, they won't find me in Hyannisport, that's for sure. Or not even in the Kennedy compound. Maybe in, you know, Cape Cod. But you can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times every week, in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu, and stay out of the water at Chappaquiddick.
I certainly will. Well, I don't drive on, you know, on docks, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I got a couple of more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now. Julie Wheeler of Beaver, West Virginia, pleaded guilty in February to healthcare fraud and faced up to 10 years in prison. So she and her husband, Rodney Wheeler, apparently cooked up a plan to keep her out of jail. On May 31st, Rodney and the couple's 17-year-old son reported that Julie had fallen from the Grand View Overlook at the New River Gorge National River. Federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies and rescue crews began a search for her, including use of a helicopter and rappelling into a jagged canyon to no avail. After 3 days of searching, however, Julie turned up hiding in a closet in her home. Now, in addition to the fraud conviction, Julie and Rodney will face multiple charges of conspiracy and giving false information to West Virginia State Police. Said U.S. Attorney Mike Stewart, "It's hard to hide at home." Yeah, sounds like Julie has the spatial awareness of a toddler playing peekaboo. And a bank robbery in Skiatook, Oklahoma, about 17 miles north of Tulsa, netted the robber $57,783. He also ordered tellers to open the ATM, but the tellers were too nervous to do it, and the robber fled. 2 months later, a bank robbery in Sperry netted an amazing $217,000 from the vault, plus $44,760 from the ATM. The robber, in the two cases, wore similar clothes and hauled the money away in a black backpack. Investigators naturally concluded the two robberies were related, which was reinforced by numerous tips pointing to the same man. Jerry Brown was known to have money problems, yet had been depositing tens of thousands of dollars in cash in various bank accounts. Plus, a teller at the first bank had recognized Brown because he's a customer at the branch. The way in which the suspect walked on his toes and his muscular build was similar to Brown, she told the FBI. Brown was arrested and suspended from his job as captain with the Tulsa Fire Department. Wow. Well, there's no tiptoeing around this one. He sounds guilty. And his career has just flamed out. In the UK, a couple put their lives on the line by having sex on railway tracks. The Randy Pair's afternoon romp delayed trains on the busy section. They were seen by a startled freight train engineer and later spotted running off over a bridge looking disheveled. A source said, "In all my 40 years working on the railway, I've never seen anything like it. They were obviously looking for a quick thrill, but if a train had come, they definitely would have been killed." They went on to say, "What a way to go. At least they would have died with a smile on their faces, I guess." A freight service first spotted the lovers. That section of line is also used by long-distance passenger services. Engineers were alerted to the danger and warned to slow down through Branston, Staffordshire. Half an hour later, the pair were seen running off over a bridge into the village and were deemed not to be a danger. British Transport Police confirmed the incident was reported to them, but no arrests were made. Yeah, being hit by a speeding train is not the climax you want to have while having sex. Nor is it the type of screaming you want. Was that good for you too? Well, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
Okay, I know that tempers are flared because of the social unrest in the U.S. after the multiple deaths of blacks at the hands of police. But seriously, you compound stupidity when you say you're going to do something stupid and you announce it in a stupid way. A Sanford, Florida man was arrested after officers said he tagged the Sanford Police Department in a Facebook post where he threatened to blow up the police station. According to an arrest affidavit, 20-year-old Daravius Tolliver tagged the police department in a Facebook post that said, in part, "I'll kill all y'all and blow up the station." Wow, he should work on his grammar. In another post, officer said Tolliver also wrote that he would turn the department into Swiss cheese. Tolliver is charged with writing or sending a threat to kill or injure, as well as threatening to bomb or discharge a destructive device. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you threaten a police department on their own Facebook page, which obviously would lead breadcrumbs right back to you? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0565. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0565. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Well, you weren't literally with him. Well, maybe you were, but I don't see how. I mean, he does record these in advance, you know. Okay, maybe you did listen with him. Who am I to call you a liar? And personally, I've never met the guy, and I'm not in a hurry to either.